Okay, Helga.
Okay, well, I have a question for Claudia from your talk. So if I understood you correctly, it was a kind of optional question: is artificial intelligence or the clinician better, and what are the values attached to that? And my question is, are there not other values involved as well related to the system within which that interaction takes place? Because, I mean, I think it was Judith yesterday who mentioned that, you know, the 7 minutes that we all get with a clinician if we're lucky. So if you look at the diagnosis, the care, and the consent, I think probably nobody has time for the second two elements. And if the machines are actually better at the first part, the diagnosis, then isn't the decision made, because the overriding value is cost effectiveness, I guess.
Right. So the simple answer to that question is yes. The whole system is value laden throughout, and the point is in trying to factor in the correct values. Now, in diagnosis, it seems to be in some instances straightforward. I mean, I've oversimplified it because obviously I was making a philosophical point, not really going off to the sort of, you know, we're not doing medicine here, so it wasn't the diagnosis that was important. But yes, there are values throughout, and it's that understanding the values that we're putting in there is going to then affect what we're getting out at the end. So that's why thinking about the consent is very important as well, because there the value seems to be about empowering the patient against maybe what's best for the health of the patient. If we make that claim that the doctor knows best, maybe the doctor doesn't know best what's healthy for the patient, because only the patient can know what they want out at the end of it.
Or maybe the doctor doesn't know how to equip the patient to make the right decisions about what's right for them.
Yes, that might be true. But it also requires something coming back from the patient as well, which was the point about reciprocity. That if the patient doesn't communicate, doesn't say, well, actually, this is the most important thing in the world for me. And people often don't know that. So that's a difficult thing sometimes to get to.
May I come in?
Like Frank?
Yes, sorry.
Eileen.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Very brief.
Yes, I'm sorry. I'd forgotten this is a panel. I'm a lousy chair.
But I understand what you're saying about value laden. But what is very important is the relationship between a doctor and patient. The patient is going to see the doctor because they're worried about whatever it is they've got, might have. And there's a kind of, I would submit, doctor, anything you say, if you can solve it. There's that kind of dominance which the doctor can have of the patient. And of course, he's got to do it in a generous, kind way. As Brom was saying, a loving way.
And she.
Yes, yeah. But there is this, I mean, I'm all for doctors having better and better tools. But it's important that must enable the doctor to conduct a humane discussion with patients.
Yes, and I would agree with that entirely. And I think that the notion of health is to do with the interaction of people. So we may all be working on different paradigms of what we think is to be healthy. And the point is to be able to communicate that so that we're all empowered. One of the things that's happening in the medical profession at the moment is the kickback coming from the legal profession in interfering in a process and turning something, wanting to make a black and white decision on something which isn't so black and white.
I'd just like to comment on the consent business. One of my favourite questions to ask a doctor is, what would you do if this was you? I don't see any reason why you couldn't ask that question of a second, third or fourth generation machine. And it would be very interesting what the answer would be. I'm optimistic. I think that machines of the future will be able to answer a question like that. What would you do if this was you? I find that very helpful. Most doctors fudge it. You know, I don't really know. But I think it would be very interesting to put that question to a machine. I certainly welcome the opportunity.
Well, I would object to that on the basis that a machine is not a human being. A machine cannot know what it is like to be human. Okay, it can get some indication, but it's always going to be an imitation. It's not going to be the real thing.
Well, that means leads on to another question. What is it to be human?
Yes. That's part of perhaps the holistic framework of situating health in saying that it's something that you has to be in the whole rather than in a part. You can't reduce it to one particular thing.
Okay.
Brendan? Which, I mean, all sorts of questions. The one question I wanted to ask Fawzia about was the word value. I'm not very familiar with ethics in a philosophical sense, but the word value itself raises all sorts of possible uses in my head. And one possible use is numbers or symbolic logic. So perhaps philosophy may have some contribution to reducing the patterns of patient narratives, particularly when they're bog standard ailments, like I've lost a leg, doctor. Oh yes, you certainly have. There can be little ambiguity about that. One can have a philosophical discussion about it, whether it actually is the case or not, but in real life it is. Or then not values, is it the price I have to pay to achieve X number of years in life, extra life, beyond now. So once upon a time, a GP said to me, he said, well, I sometimes ask people, when they come in asking about, their cholesterol and their blood pressure and all that sort of stuff, they said, well, how long do you want to live? and that usually people would actually be a bit stumped. You have to be careful about now who you ask that question. Not everybody can handle that question. How long do you want to live? And so I said, well, I'd like to live until I'm 80. Well, that's fine. Well, there are five things you need to think about. Your blood pressure, your cholesterol, blah, blah, blah. So, in other words, you're throwing the value of this consultation back onto the patient. So, again, I mean, there is no answer, I know, but it's a good question, I think, what is value and what value do you put in the computer?
Right. So that was my whole point of looking at the question, could machines replace clinicians, was to explore that deeper question, if you remember on the first slide, was what is the relation between facts, values and health? Because values and facts and health are all abstract notions. Mm. So that's the difficulty. So yes, you can see somebody hasn't got a limb, that's a fact, but there's also a value attached to that for the patient, okay? So we might say, well, do you want an artificial prosthetic? Now, for somebody who says, actually, no, I don't want to have that. I know of a case of a young lad who was born with deformities of his leg. He's had one leg amputated. The other leg is sort of okay, but it's withered. He's got a nice prosthetic on one side, and he's saying now that he wants the withered limb, which is otherwise normal. He's got some function out of it, but he hasn't got the function that he's getting off out of the artificial limb. So, yes, there's a fact about not having a leg, but there's also a value attached into it. And that was my point about talking about the fact-value dichotomy and the two being entangled. Yeah. We can't separate them out.
And it seems very difficult to arrange some sort of a piston system of values so that you find that balance, that particular combination, that balance which that particular person would choose to have if they knew what was there in their best interests.
Yes, that's where we're going to. And it's rather than thinking about in terms of values, this vague word, that maybe we need to be thinking about in terms of priority. What is the priority for the patient? And that is actually what their value lies in, the priority.
Yeah, so by thinking about it. Okay, right.
Frank's next. If you put your hand up, you are on my list. So,
leading on from that a bit, a quick question and a comment. The quick question is, AI, you seem to imply, is applied to diagnosis, but does it also apply to treatment?
Okay, well, I was looking at the philosophical issues rather than the actual practical issues. So are you looking at a philosophical angle there?
Well, no, I mean, the fact it applies to diagnosis seems to have some very practical implications.
Yes.
Let's use it and get better diagnoses. But if it applies also to treatment, it seems to me that I can understand how you could put 2 million cases or more into the machine as a very strong basis for making the right diagnosis. But when it comes to treatment, you're into a huge number of imponderables, the particular case of this patient. Now, maybe you can group those kinds of particular cases in some sort of a way, but this is where the doctor-patient relationship and the particularities of the case would seem to make a huge difference, which might vitiate a treatment recommendation. I mean, maybe there's a standard treatment for standard measles, but in this case, that treatment might be impossible or cause other difficulties and so on and so on. You could think of a million other cases where that's the case. So to what extent is the scope for AI also to apply to treatment?
Right, that's a very good question, Frank. Thank you very much. Because one of the issues we have then, whenever we've got a diagnosis and we're thinking about a treatment, is what is the intervention going to be? And any intervention, this is the horrible thing, always comes at some cost. Okay. Now, we can look back to the past and say we've done this intervention in the past, and we might say it's 99% successful. But it's rare when we get to a case where we can say it's 100% successful in every case and there are no side effects. I mean, I can't think of many instances where that happens. So you've got to always weigh that risk and balance reward. And that's where the personal element comes into it. Because what one person might think is acceptable is another person's unacceptability. Now, maybe, and I can take Judith's point, that maybe you could sit in front of a computer machine and you could put in, well, you know, this is what I want, this is what I don't want, and it could then collate all that information together and say, given all of that, this is the best treatment plan for you. So I could see it sort of working that way. I suppose the issue I have underneath it is that as human beings, a lot of people haven't done that amount of thinking. So they think they want one thing, and then when they get that unexpected outcome, it's the outcome that they knew was a possibility, but it's not what they wanted. And now they're desperately unhappy. And that's something that the machine can't do anything about, because the machine can't offer you that sort of reassurance, that sort of emotional sort of side to things. At least I don't think the machine can do the emotion bit.
I think a machine could ask a better quality of question.
Yes, I would agree with that.
And elucidate some better quality answers that might help the patient to think more clearly.
Yes, I would agree.
I just want to take you up on the fact the machine can't do this because it's not human. There are some doctors that I wonder.
Only a few.
I agree with that.
Present company accepted. But, you know, I don't think we can lay that on a machine, what it means to be human. There are some doctors that fall miserably short of that. So.
Yes, but we would hope that during the training we would wheedle them out.
Well, this is post-training.
Are there any more comments before I go into the next?
No, please carry on.
That annoyed me, the last comment. Sorry. I think what a machine will never ever be able to do is show empathy, and I agree with what you're saying. And we mustn't go down that track. It's a myth. We must train doctors to be able to respond to the patient, look them in the face and see the pain they're having, and focus on that individual. Yeah. We must become human.
I
was just about to say, perhaps, just as on this point, perhaps we should program the machine to select young people to go to medical school. Just a thought.
To select?
Select entrance to medical school.
Yeah. Oh. I think that is happening at the moment.
Rather than the people with the best A-level grades, which used to be the case, they got these very clever kind of, sometimes slightly psychotic.
and just offering although on one level, David, I'm totally with you, I would just offer a defence on behalf of Judith that would say that because these machines are now becoming very good at pattern recognition, you can actually program them to recognise pain. Now, they won't have that feeling of pain, but they can recognise that here is somebody in pain.
Okay. We've got a huge number of questioners here. So, Simon.
Yeah, it's not so much a question as a point about the robot surgeon situation. So, it was mentioned what happens.
Okay, can you speak up a bit, please?
Yeah, what happens if, during the operation, the machine goes wrong? And then. Now, it reminds me of an analogous situation in airline travel where cabin crews have come to rely so much on autopilot that when crises occurred, in two or three occasions, they weren't able to deal with the crisis because they had become de-skilled, and that had ended with fatal outcomes. So, you know, there is that ethical consideration that needs to be made about how much power we give over to machines and remove the skills from the human practitioners. The other point also is that you talked about knowing what paradigm we're moving towards. Of course, in Kuhnian terms, you can't know the paradigm until you get there.
Well, that's true, right. So, in response to the first one, I'm wondering, is that really an ethical consideration or is that a practical consideration? I think about the computers that we used to have a number of years ago in business, and the worry was, oh my goodness, this computer fails, it's got all our data in it, disaster. So the clever bods out there sort of thought, this is a problem, how do we solve it? We need backup solutions. So we start having backups of data, and then what we find is in the big systems, in big companies, okay, the NHS excluded, that had all the big problem, and British Airways as well, you have backups and backups and backups. So it's not really, I think, an ethical consideration. It's more a sort of a practical problem. How do we get around this? We know the failure occurs. But not if you had the backup for it. So if you develop the backup and you've backed up and backed up and backed up, you've got the same sort of risk when you're operating with a human being. Human beings are valuable, okay? So we're likely to get less error, in a way, coming out of the machine, providing we've got people who can program it, okay? That's the practical issue, which I don't want to deal with because that's out there. I just want to deal with the thought process of going on behind it.
I would ask Colin. Simon. It's a trick question, so please take it as a trick. If you were told that the operation being done by a machine had a 90% success rate and a 10% failure rate, which figure would you prefer?
Well, I prefer the 90% success rate. Right. I've not actually got the problem with the machine doing the operation.
I'm quite
happy with that.
So your airline situation.
Yeah, I'm just pointing out.
Yeah, yeah. You've got 90%, it's a very crude, 90% success, A to B, 10% failure, A to B. Could we do a clinical trial to compare human rates of success and failure against the machine? And I suspect, at the end of the day, that the machine might just get the edge.
The point I was making was not that the machine, the autopilot shouldn't be used, that machines shouldn't do operations. I'm arguing about if a human has to, or I'm pointing out, I'm pointing out that if a human has to intervene, it's important to maintain that their skill level is such that they can do that.
Yeah.
If we rely too much on the technology, then the possibility of intervention being an efficacious one. Going by the problems with the autopilot is something that wasn't considered. So the cabin crews did not know how to deal with the crisis because they'd lost that skill.
Yeah.
So it's, like I say, it's not a challenge.
No. But it's I mean, it is actually real and true that the more a junior doctor practices a procedure, whether it's medical or surgical, and is exposed to a variety of people coming in with slight variations on their same illness, the more skillful that young doctor becomes. And the same applies to your airline pilot situations, etc. There seems to be, I can't think of any way around making that decision. Are you going to go for the computer program, or are you going to stick with the human input? We may have to make a choice.
It's problematic, but
I don't know.
And is what they've done with the pilots is they've continued, they've realised that's the case, so they've put them into the practical situations to deal with them.
Is it? Is it?
And I think we're going on too long with this.
Can I go on then? Okay. Chris, please.
Sorry, this has already been touched on, but I'd like to draw it out a bit further. What these various machine interventions produce are, in fact, probabilities. So if you ask a diagnostic program, what is the chance that I have chickenpox? It will actually give you a it won't say yes or no, it'll give you a probability. And if you look at machines doing operations, for instance, you can measure the probability of the success of that operation or the failure of it. Now, what I discovered over coffee is that people's attitude to the risk, in other words, the failure side of that probability, varies enormously. And speaking personally, if it was a 60-40, I'd always go with the 60. But what I think I discovered, if you're looking at a 90-10, under certain circumstances, people would assume the 10 and act accordingly rather than assume the 90 and act accordingly. Now, I wouldn't, but clearly a huge portion of the population will say, I'm going to assume I'm in the 10% and I will perhaps ask for a major operation rather than doing nothing. And whilst we're in that situation, it seems very difficult to bring any sort of logic to bear on the way the public are going to react to these various machine interventions.
Right, okay. Yeah. And I think that's the whole thing about priorities coming in. Because how you're absolutely right. People will decide on different levels of risk. Mm-hmm. But I don't think the decision is just cold, black and white on the numbers. It's what lies behind the numbers. If I tell you, let's try and take an example. Say you've got a problem with your eyes, right? And I say to you, we can give you a corneal transplant, okay? Success rate of corneal transplant is about 96%. Failure rate is 4%, right? But now you might ask me, what does it mean if I'm in the 4% failure rate, right? So you've got some vision at the moment, but your vision is, you're functioning with your vision, but you want to have better vision, and they're saying the only way you'll get better vision is to have this corneal transplant. But then I tell you, well, if you're in the 4% failure rate, there's a chance of you going blind, right? Yeah. So now you've got to weigh up, how important is it for me to have, fantastic vision, compared to the blurry vision I've got at the moment, if I'm actually risking not having any vision at all. So the numbers aren't as quite as...
You have to make some level of judgment. But I might go on to say, okay, if I have nothing done and live with my blurred vision, my defective vision, what is the prognosis in a year's time, in 5 years' time?
Yeah.
And that would also influence my judgment on how I deal with that risk factor.
Yes, and this is just the point I'm getting to, that it's there aren't facts in here. There is the fact based upon the probability of the prognosis, but there is also the way in which you then identify whether you want to take that risk or not. And that's, as you pointed out in your earlier bit that you said, that's very individual.
Yeah. And also, I do worry to the extent that the present company accepted where we would want to address these risks in something approaching a rational form. I wish I thought that was true of the population in general.
Exactly. That, and that's the whole problem, where the legal process kicks in, and then you know, we're into a different ballgame, because that's looking at us trying to say absolutes, and you're not.
Just wanted to comment, when you're using numbers like that 90-10%, then it comes to me that perhaps an important factor here would be cognitive dissonance. If I believe that I'm ill and I'm going to die, or whatever it is, then I'm going to push the likely 4% into something much bigger. I'm going to be persuaded by that. And that's why a doctor does need to look at the patient as a whole human being. They're coming in with their fears, their anxiety, what people have told them of treatment, and they need to be...
But why, under the circumstances, why would you believe that?
You believe it because you're committed to the belief, because everybody's told you that. This is what cognitive dissonance is about.
And we come across a lot of cognitive dissonance. But for example, you know, people who smoke. Now, that's a classic case. There's plenty of information, plenty of data out there about the risks of smoking, and yet people go out and do it, and then they come in with a problem, and then they go, oh, if only I would have known. And you say, well, it was out there in the literature, you do know. And some of them are honest and say, yeah, I sort of knew that stuff was out there, but I didn't think it was going to happen to me. And that's the point. When you hear these numbers, like you hear 96% success rate, you sort of think, oh, I'm going to be in that success rate. But then you turn out to be in the 4%. It's disastrous for you. It's 100% wrong for you.
Yes.
Okay. Quick.
Yeah. If there was one book that I could recommend for every philosopher, or amateur and academic, to look at, it's the book by Danny... I forget his name. So Fast Thinking, Slow Thinking.
It covers all of it.
It's really, I think it's a starting point to distinguish between what is our psychology and what is our philosophy.
Yes.
Right, next person is John.
This isn't a question. I'm really intrigued about robots replacing...
Can you speak up, please, for the people at the back?
I'm intrigued about this debate we've had of robots replacing surgeons, because I recently had to visit Plymouth Hospital, and I see they're moving in that direction, because there's an enormous yellow sign at the entrance to the hospital that says, warning, guard dogs operate at this hospital.
Okay, that's it. Yeah.
Yes, sorry.
Oh, it's a joke.
He didn't hear what David said. 90% a joke.
Okay, Bob Stone.
I suppose this is also on AI, but it in fact probably directed as much at what I think Judith is going to say, is anyone. I can see that if I went to the doctor about my eyes, chicken pox, Achilles tendon, I would be much more confident in what a machine told me, and also in how a machine operated on me, than I would be with a doctor. I'm happy with all that. But as soon as you get onto some sort of what we would conventionally call mental condition, supposing I thought I might have depression, where it isn't just a matter of diagnosing what I've got as a matter of fact, but a whole interpretation of whether, for instance, I'm suffering from the social circumstances that David might think from the way society's gone in the last 50 years, or what, then the machine is going to be no better, really, than the programmers. The programmers would have told the machine, here are a load of possible labels which the condition may have. Whereas, in fact, a doctor, a human being, might be able to exercise some imagination, might even believe that the conventional mental illnesses and mental illness classification simply weren't accurate. in a way that a machine never could, I don't think. Unless it was generation 20 machine. And so I would be worried about the whole notion of artificial intelligence in the area of what we call mental health, because of, there are so many things other than simply working out what the facts are that are going on in the diagnosis. How's that grab you?
I'd just like to say a doctor is also programmed, you know, by his upbringing,
yes,
his circumstances. I don't see why you think a machine can't interrogate you and find out just as much as it, or more so than it. We're talking about a level of AI which is not going to be generation 100. It's coming fast, where it's going to be equivalent, if not supersede, our intelligence. I mean, there's a lot of information out there when this is going to happen, the tipping point. But I don't see, even now, why a machine couldn't interrogate you to find out all sorts of things that a doctor may not even bother to do.
Yeah, that's fair enough, but would the machine have the imagination to go beyond? I mean, most doctors wouldn't, but they might have. To go beyond what it's been programmed by previous doctors,
yes,
to expect.
Machines are learning now. They're learning. They're not just blind programmed things. They're learning.
And also underneath the first set of premises anyway, which you called facts, are actually a certain assumptions about what it is that it is a fact. I mean, I think there's some people in this room who are perhaps more qualified than I to talk about this. I don't know if Tim wants to have a word on that. Is that right? That we've got these assumptions that everything's based on, and we need to try and get underneath what these assumptions are first.
Well, I think maybe in that example, what strikes me is that you don't. The machine, as Judith is saying, it can be a learning machine. That it doesn't just follow the reasoning of the programmer, and actually there doesn't need to be any diagnosis involved there at all. As long as the machine can see a pattern between these sort of symptoms reported, or indeed the patient responds to this set of questions in this set of ways, and all the patients that respond in that set of way when treated with this drug tend to get better or get worse. And so you look for patterns. So you can actually have a situation where no one, including the machine, knows why a certain drug is working. We just know that it tends to work. And so hence you get the neural networks. And so there might actually be no underlying facts in that.
I'm not quite sure that you really said what is really at the back of your head. In your head.
Tell me.
I'm trying to draw it out, and I suspect there is a little bit. It's not quite as black and white as it may appear. Are you wondering if there's a lack of insight in the machine, that there's this suddenly I can be inside your head. I can see how you see. Is that or not?
Not particularly. I don't go a bundle on this empathy business. Do I have to get that in? Just no. It's just the idea of diagnosing somebody with a mental health problem depends so much on the social constructions, as it was put several lectures ago. Of what we consider to be mental health and so mental illness. But I wonder if a machine would be as capable as an imaginative doctor of forgetting everything that has been told about programmed with about mental health, and saying there's nothing wrong with you, all you need is a different job. I'm making that up, but
yeah,
I just wonder if in the end, a doctor in that situation might have more flexibility than a machine.
No, is the answer. Because the doctor will always play safe. Because the doctor will never go beyond the current classification. It will not be. It's unsafe to go beyond the classification, because you end up in court.
Well,
so doctors will tend to stay in that direction. But if I could tell you that there's a move within certain countries in the psychiatric profession, I think Alex would be much better. A shame he isn't here, because he would talk much better about this, I think. He might confirm that, for example, the word schizophrenia has always been a contentious term, has always been never satisfactory.
Very, very.
What does it mean?
Oh, God.
Don't go there. Change that. Stop using it. And just use the word the psychotic syndrome or the psychotic spectrum. In other words, a vague diagnosis, which is very often the case in psychiatric profession. Mm-hmm. The diagnosis is just something, it's something to put a hat on. Lots of hats. Then you then try to create, assemble a team approach to support this person. So the indirect answer is the doctor will never jump beyond the classification.
In
practice will not jump beyond it. It would be unsafe to jump beyond the classification. Not strictly by the DCM, but in general, as your colleagues would support you in court. So there would never really be the imaginative jump. I think you're talking about going beyond the classification.
So in practice, the machine is going to make a better job of sticking within the guidelines than the doctor.
It would arguably predict. Could if that's a reasonable prediction? Let's do the trial and see how it works. Volunteers, please.
Okay. Colin, you were next.
Oh, yeah. Can a machine have courage? Can a machine have courage?
Okay. Yeah. They're thinking. They're thinking about it.
Well, the claim I put up there is that a machine is not a human being. And it cannot feel what it is to be a human being. And courage, I think, is in the human dimension. Now, if we could define what courage is, and of course, as we know, philosophers go back to Socrates standing in the marketplace and having loads of people coming forward saying, I know what courage is, and he shoots them all down. So until we can form an algorithm of something, then I don't think a machine can, unless somebody in computer science is going to tell me otherwise.
Sorry, can I just offer you an algorithm? The algorithm would be to program the machine to switch itself off after a certain degree of disability has been detected.
Is that courage, though? Is that the definition of courage? Is that not just saying
let's function? That a human being can still say, I'm completely dead. Think of Stephen Hawking. Think of that man. He's been totally incapacitated for decades, and he still wants to live. He still has courage. I think that's something that you can't factor into machines, in my opinion.
But you can. It goes back to what I said to Bob. A brave doctor is not a doctor you really want.
Right.
You really don't want a brave doctor.
Yeah.
Because bravery, in my definition, is doing something which you really shouldn't be doing. But there is more to it, of course. But in civilian life, there is no such thing as a brave doctor. There is a doctor who will, in a desperate situation, which is not entirely covered by the medical books, there are always variations and there are always circumstances which occur. When an imaginative stepping up and looking down at the whole situation in a very clear manner and seeing the picture instantly and quickly, perhaps, and then going on and doing that, even though your colleagues are all freaking out. Now, maybe that is correct, mm-hmm. in the medical sense, but that is a civilian sense. In the frontline sense, I have no idea what courage is. I've never been there.
Can I just respond to that? Yeah. I'm just thinking about how medicine has changed and sort of thinking about my own experiences here. And you're right to say that we have this sort of box within which we sit beyond which we know if we do that, we're going to land up in court. So what is pushing back against us is not anything to do with health. It's to do with what the courts will or will not allow us to do in a legal framework. So one of the things that's happened over the years is we've sort of seen sort of some of the Eastern philosophies and Eastern medicines coming in with the introduction of complementary medicines, things like reflexology, acupuncture. And in the early stages of that, Western doctors weren't touching it, okay? You weren't allowed to touch it. And now, bit by bit, people have started to realize, because of some, what we might put in your definition there, brave doctors have said, well, actually, I want to try this out. I'm hearing all this data stuff. Why don't I see if it works? And then when those brave doctors actually go out there and they try it and it works and it seemed to be successful, then we move into a new sort of paradigm, really, where now some of these complementary medicines, which would have been out of fashion previously, are now becoming fashionable. So that's how things change, maybe, because of bravery.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right, Stuart.
I wanted to ask Judith about her optimistic view of AI and machines of the future. Because what I'm wondering about is using cold data, okay, machine data, for making decisions. Couldn't this raise questions as to the criteria that is used, for instance, who or who does not have key operations, taking into account financial considerations and the amount of people that can be treated? Would we find a situation through a machine favouring a 35-year-old with a brilliant career to come over a 60-year-old, which, by the way, would perhaps take most of the people in this room out of the equation, and that an extremely obese smoker would not only be put to the back of the queue, but be pushed off the railway bridge to stop the train?
We never do that.
This is happening anyway. This is happening without the aid of computers. When the major decisions are made, the young man with the dependent family will be given the risky operation first over the 60-year-old with the majority of his life behind him. Yeah. And if you're obese or a smoker, you just have to sit and wait. This is happening already.
Yeah. So this is therefore leading quite happily to euthanasia.
Ooh, that explains that. How so?
Well, what I'm saying is that you can have a machine making decisions that say, right, this section of the population is not going to have a chance to recover, so the next stage for these people is death.
Yeah.
And that is a form of euthanasia.
Yeah. Mm. Do you want me to... that is, I think, a logical conclusion of Brave New World. That in a state that is so well organised, is sufficient, cost-effective, that the resources match the expenditure, you choose to do all this, and yes, we would end up in robot nation, is a literary narrative which should be written. I think Aldous Huxley pointed the way many, many years ago. The answer is maybe.
Who knows? Maybe. Lacks compassion.
But this, we're not talking about a machine. We're talking about reality now, operated in the human world. Those issues you've just raised are current. They're not being solved by machines. They're being applied by human beings. Yeah. So why would machines not do that?
Okay.
We don't trust them.
Okay. We've now got 6 people and 11 minutes, so please be quick, questioners and answerers.
Will it never end?
Mike is next.
Right, I'll be as quick as I can.
Yes.
I'm
I'd like to go back to the general theme of the meeting, really. My question is really simply, what do I mean when I raise a glass and wish a friend good health? But perhaps the reason, my motivation is perhaps a bit more, sorry, a bit more interesting than that. I mean, you asked us to consider the philosophy of health, implying, I would have thought in that there's somehow a narrative or a theory about health. And presumably that has metaphysical and ontological commitments, and that statements about health have some meaning. So I go back to my meaning of chit. You know, we've been reminded that by both questioners and presenters, that we know what the word health is, and that we use it with a reasonable expectation that the people we talk to will understand what we're talking about. We've also been reminded that it's got an ancient tradition, stemming from ancient Greece through Middle English and German, through to a modern sort of context, and that various cultures have correlates of what we consider at the moment to be health now. So we are talking about something. This weekend, you know, I've heard really. And the points that I've retained, I'm left with a feeling that we spent a lot of time on a post-mortem with rather negative connotations. Indeed, Judith, you asked us what was the meaning of illness, for example. Now, are we dealing with a concept which is a catch-all of the aspects which man is born to suffer, in Schopenhauer's views, or is there a more positive aspect that we can take and consolidate from the discussion we've had today? And I'd like to ask each of the panel members, really, that whether they consider there is a philosophy of health, and if so, what would be their favourite component to consider when we start to build up, in a reasonable way, what a philosophy of health might consider?
Right, okay. That's a very big question. Who wants to start?
Old statement, here's a health theory, as you say.
Yeah.
I did try to find out where that usage came from, but I couldn't find it out. You're asking a good question. You're asking, what is the philosophy? Philosophy.
I'm asking, is there a philosophy?
Yes,
you say no, and if you say yes, we should be able to tell you what's in it.
If you go, I haven't found it. I haven't found it on Google. I haven't found it in any books that I've looked at. I would actually, my way of looking at this is I would actually put it into a bigger picture. And I would put it into a bigger picture. The bigger picture would be something along the lines of the philosophy of being human. I would ask, ask that question. That would be a bigger paradigm, a bigger picture. And then within that, I would posit health and perhaps lots of other things. But is that out there? I'm sure there are already references and sources that would somehow deal something of that, but I don't think it's actually been all done and put together in a package. I'm not taught in current philosophy, undergraduate, and I'm not aware of anybody doing postgraduate work. Maybe there is, but that's the best answer I can give you.
Thank you.
I'd just like to add that there's a philosophy of everything as far as I can see. Why there shouldn't be a philosophy of health, I don't know. And what is health? It seems that we've heard health is both subjective and objective. There you have it. If you feel good, comfortable, healthy, that's one definition. If you get an investigation to your well woman, well man, and they say, whoops, all your readings show that you're unhealthy, then you've got an ambiguity. But how you solve that, I don't know, it's up to the individual whether
So I started with the introduction in which I said that philosophy of health is a new branch of philosophy. one that scholars are only just starting to get underneath. There's an MA being offered by Birmingham University at the moment, Philosophy of Health and Happiness, which seems to then suggest in some way that health is associated with happiness, which of course then raises all the questions of, well, we don't know what health is and we don't know what happiness is. Now, there is also
By pure coincidence, I had an alert from the British Journal of the Philosophy of Science that came in today, and this new article is entitled "Health as a Secondary Property," and I think a very philosophical discussion which I would recommend to you. You can British Journal of Philosophy of Science. If you Google it, it's an Oxford journal, and I think these articles are now downloadable free via open access. Okay. British Journal for the Philosophy of Science, and it's health as a secondary property. You know, Locke, primary, secondary qualities. Okay, looks like a very good article. So the answer is, yes, it is a philosophical issue. Okay.
Yeah, and if you remember back to one of the slides I put earlier on, we've got questions about what does health mean, what is it, what are the necessary sufficient conditions of it, how do we measure it, what are its implications for policy going forward. So I think it's an area that I'm hoping is going to start growing, because I think there are important issues here that we need to bring to light and try to grapple with. But as for, is there a lot of stuff out there at the moment? No, there isn't. We need to start creating it, folks.
Mm. Well, there seems to be more. Actually, I think with this article, there must be a bibliography connected with it. So I shall share this with you later. Yeah. Okay.
So I would suggest that, and it's come across very clearly from all the discussions that happened in the last couple of days, I would suggest that the philosophy of health is a branch of ethics. Because everything we've discussed involves the word ought. What should we do? What ought we be doing? And then you're back to ethics. And I think that's where we should be going.
I'm not quite convinced about that. As I suggested in the introduction, I think it arises out of philosophy of medicine and philosophy of healthcare. From the healthcare, you get the ethics side. But from the medicine, you might say, well, no, it's not that ethical approach in it. The ethics comes in the healthcare, not in the actual medical stuff itself.
No, but what you say, I've got a chunk of money to spend on medical provisions. What should I be doing with it?
But that's healthcare.
Yeah.
That's healthcare provisions. Oh, yeah. So we've got the different aspects of it, because we're trying to think, you know, how do we make people healthier? Now you might say, well, is there an ethical consideration? Yeah, well, there's a question of should we be making people healthier? But if we've made the decision, first of all, that health is an important thing, and we had that quote from Descartes, if you remember, health is a primary good, if we really believe that, then it's taking us already in a different direction.
But it's open to question.
Right, Jean, and we've got three people about to fall off the list, so quicker the better.
I'm very impressed with that. What a responsibility. My own feeling about modern Western philosophy is that it's really only nibbled at the very edges of what it is to be a person. I can't go with positive. I would like to just share an experience I have. Our daughter had kidney failure as a child and adolescent, and we were referred to Guy's Hospital, and she had a transplant which, after a week, failed disastrously, and nobody realized at the time. I could see something was wrong. All of the nurses and doctors thought it was fine. I won't go into it. And then in the night it became, obviously it had disintegrated, and the kidney had to be taken out the next day. I felt terrible. I went to bed feeling all my energy had just gone. I woke up the next morning, came to the ward in this depressed mood. Four people apologized to me for not understanding and sympathized with me, and I was even brought a cup of tea, which was unheard of, guys. And to my surprise, I was restored by the end of that day to my normal self. and I had my energy back and my ability to go forward back. This was totally unexpected, but I learned from that there's something going on there, because this happened, and I think it must happen to others.
I would agree with that, which is why I was saying about the issue of reassurance, and I think that that's an important component of help, that sort of reassurance, feeling at one with the world that comes with that.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Okay. Helga? Did you?
I had a question for Brendan, because if you mentioned...
Can you speak up, please?
You mentioned... Brendan, you mentioned something very interesting around...
Did I?
Yes.
Thank you.
That you actually want... you don't want the surgeon or the clinician to be imaginative or brave.
Oh, yeah.
And my question to you is, where do you see that leading... What does that mean for medical progress? Because surely all progress comes from the imagination. And if we separate on the one hand the clinician that has the exposure to patients... and learn from that, and then the medical research totally different, where does that
lead us? Yeah, I mean, there's a very practical answer to that, and it's happened all the time, and it's that the new idea, the new operation, the new drug, is more often than not, after the clinical trials have been done, okay, we've got all that out of the way, so there is some advantage to it. It tends to be tried out on the worst cases, on the desperate cases, the people who are at, there is, everything else has been tried, and there's nothing left. So what do we do? Let's perhaps try this new thing that's come on. That tends to be how it happens. So there's a very practical answer to that. Doctors are, so if that is not doctors being brave, that's doctors being hopeful. If they were being brave, they would try it out on much sturdier patients.
And I would tell.
Oh, now. Oh, you're going. I mean, that's a very silly answer. And I apologise for that. But I hope I addressed? Not really.
Not really.
Bravery?
It seems to me, I mean, you said that basically. Learn, and that makes perfect sense as a clinician, as in any other job, by seeing lots of patients and the experience and all the rest of it. So then those people to me seem also well suited to having seen a lot of different things. All of a sudden this light bulb goes on and the imagination, oh, maybe there is a different way of treating it, and if we separate that and we leave the diagnosis and the interaction to the machine, how do we make medical progress? Maybe we don't want to make medical progress. Maybe we have a population and we don't want to make more progress. But,
we form concepts. We're a concept-forming agency, as Vico, as I said, Gambia Tista Vico. We make up concepts. Yeah, we do. And this is the leap of imagination, the outcome of a little bit of research, hard research. The machine can do that. I think the machines can learn. But again, I think it's a question of working it through, and I see where you're coming from. I do. I have no answer. I'm sorry.
Can I just say very quickly on that, just picking up on the point that Tim made earlier on about pattern recognition. So when you're feeding in all the data, the machine is learning, as I understand it, by looking at these patterns and interpreting them in different ways. So that's where the imagination is coming in, is that ability to interpret the data in a different way to the standard way. The clinicians, because I think where Brendan's definition of bravery comes from, is that you're faced with the legal consequences of if you were to do this with this patient and it went wrong, you'd land up in court. So that's where you'd have to be brave in order to do that, I suggest.
Okay. Can I just squeeze Fiona in very quickly?
Very specific. The question about how AI would deal with complexity. So people don't always have only one thing wrong with them at a time. So the medics will have experienced a lot of elderly patients that have a complex set of problems, and they're on a cocktail of drugs, and the drugs are interacting. For example, I mean, I've experienced a parent with polymyalgia, rheumatoid arthritis, osteoporosis, and then a chest infection on top of that. I was sinking fast. I mean, would AI cope you know, would that be a classic situation where that sort of interaction would never have happened in the first place? Would you apply the algorithms?
My view would be that the machine should do well outperform the physician, yeah. Because the problem is that we're often trying to use a reductionist approach, and what the machines can do is they've got all this massive information, millions and millions of interactions. I mean, one human being in a lifetime couldn't get to the amount of data that you've got stored in those machines. They've been accumulating data now for the last 60 odd years.
So it would be able to keep all those plates spinning.
Oh, yes. And it would be going out and it would be grabbing, as Tim was saying, looking for the patterns. And that's what we will only deal with, you know, one issue at each time. I think that's the problem in mental. So hopefully machines do that.
Machines could perhaps give a second opinion all the time.
Yes.
Test the doctors. I mean, and audit the doctors, and then you but it's interesting. Just one final comment. There's a number of there's a certain medical presence here, and there doesn't seem to be any hostility to AI contributing or even taking over from the practice of medicine. Interesting.
Okay. Right. Well, I think that's it. Bar time. Thank you very much, everyone, for coming along, and thank you to our speakers. I think we've had a wonderful weekend. Thank you for organising it.
Thank you.
It's been very stimulating. Thank you.
Big thank you to Eileen as well. She's done so much work in the background.